and welcome to Addressing Alaskans, a program capturing community conversations in South Central Alaska. Join us each week on KSKA Anchorage and travel to different spots throughout our community to listen to local groups gathered to discuss what matters to Alaskans. This week, author and New Yorker columnist Susan Orlean joins Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley for an onstage conversation about writing, people, and place. The 49 Alaska Writing Center hosted both columnists as part of their Cross Current series at the Anchorage Museum on Friday, April 1st.
Good evening. We're so glad to have you here. My name is Deb Vanas, and I'm welcoming you on behalf of 49 Writers. 49 Writers is an organization that supports the work of Alaska writers and promotes Alaskan books. We have classes and events like this one and other programs and events that support writing and books in the state of Alaska. I'd like to thank several people tonight and organizations for helping put this together. The Alaska Travel Industry Association is one of our sponsors tonight, as is the Copper Whale Inn. And of course, the Anchorage Museum, and in particular, Mark Weber with the Anchorage Museum Bookstore. And I'd like to give a huge thanks to my very faithful and capable volunteer coordinator for this event, Karen Benning.
Welcome. It's great to see so many faces tonight. We're so pleased to have Susan Orlean and Julia O'Malley here tonight. Thank you all for coming this evening. To make the question and answer session go smoothly at the end of the conversation, we're going to hand out cards toward the end of the discussion. Please feel free to write down any questions you have or raise your hand and we'll give you a card and you can write the question and then hand the card back in. And then they'll just take the cards and that'll just make things go more efficiently. Many of you are probably familiar with Julia O'Malley's work through her column in the Anchorage Daily News. She grew up right here in Anchorage and has also written for the Anchorage Press, the Juneau Empire, and the Oregonian. She's been writing full-time for the Anchorage Daily News since 2005. Her online bio says that she has written, quote, extensively about life in Anchorage. As any of you who have read her work know, this is an understatement. O'Malley has observed life in a historic bar, a Buddhist temple, and the Red Apple grocery store. She has written of aspiring politicians and addicts, physicians and immigrants, and high school students. Her stories taken together tell a new, bigger story of Anchorage, one that digs well past what we thought we knew about our own community. In 2008, O'Malley won the Scripps Howard Foundation's Ernie Pyle Award for the best human interest writing in the country, quote, for finding untold stories in often overlooked places. Anchorage is lucky to have a writer as insightful and compassionate as Julia O'Malley. Please help me welcome Julia O'Malley.
Hi, thank you guys all for coming. I have the pleasure of getting to introduce Susan Orlean, and I just wanted to tell someone the story of how it is that Susan Orlean came to Alaska, because I just think it's cool, because she's cool. But it started with David Hewlin. I don't know where, he's probably not here, but he's my editor. And he gave me this cassette tape that's super old, and it's from the 90s, and it's Susan Orlean talking at a writing conference. And I didn't have anything else in my car for like 6 months, and so I drove around listening to Susan Orlean all the time. And then I got in a car accident and the car was totaled and I forgot to take the tape out, so that's what happened to it. But anyway, and so then after that, and I was trying to sort of come up with a speaker for the press club, and people kept suggesting things to me, and I was like bouncing it off people in the newsroom, and they would be like, "Who's that?" And finally, and you know, they didn't like anyone. So, and one day I had this guy all lined up, and I like laid it on my coworker Lisa, and she was like, "Yeah, I don't know who that is." And so I went and sat down at my desk, and I am on Twitter, and Susan tweeted something, and I was like, you know, maybe she would come here. So I just tweeted her. I said, "Hey, would you come to Alaska and speak to the press club?" And she tweeted back in like 45 minutes later and was like, okay. And I was like, oh my God. Anyway, and then, you know, thanks to the generous support of a bunch of sponsors that we were able to line up to support our event, we were able to bring her here. So one of the things that's really cool about her is that she's really tremendously game, and she's adventurous. She just got off the plane and drove right down to Girdwood, no problem. I don't even know if I could do that, like, in another place. But anyway, so without any more rambling, please let me present to you New Yorker staff writer since 1992 and author of The Orca Thief, The Bullfighter Checks Her Makeup, My Kind of Place, as well as an upcoming book about Rin Tin Tin, a woman who has profiled a 10-year-old boy, a grocery store, tween surfer girls, and taxidermists, who has already seen caribou, moose, and taken a dog sled ride, Susan Orlean.
Thank you. I'm so happy to be here, and I have so many people to thank for making this happen. I don't want to forget anyone, so I will just say thank you all. I really appreciate it, and especially thanks to Julia for being game enough to ask me if I would come, and I'm thrilled to be here. It's really exciting for me, I have to admit. This is my first trip to Alaska, excuse me, and I'm just thrilled to be here. So, and I hope I'll come back again. And thank you all for being here tonight. I really appreciate it. Such a warm welcome. I'm going to read a short section from the book I just finished. And of course, I'm using you as guinea pigs. It's an opportunity for me to find typos and things. So, forgive me. But it's also, I guess, kind of a special opportunity to read something new. So I hope you'll indulge me. I have to tell you a little bit before I read this so you know some of a few of the facts that will make this make sense. My book is a cultural biography of the dog actor Rin Tin Tin. What I did in the course of this book was basically follow the story of this dog from his birth in the real world. He was really born in on a battlefield. I'm sorry, excuse me for losing my voice here. He was born in World War I on a battlefield in France and became a huge film star in the 20s, a vaudeville star in the 30s, a star of talking film in the 40s, and a television star in the 50s, and a rerun star in the 60s, 70s, 80s, and 90s. And I know you're all too smart to think it was the same dog, so I won't insult you with the stating the obvious that this was ultimately generations of the dog. I'm going to read to you from a section of the book where one of the things I did was go both to see where the original Rin Tin Tin was born in France and then also where he was buried. So I'm going to read to you from the section where I went to find his grave. And the only thing you need to know in order to make this make sense is that he was found on that battlefield by an American GI named Lee Duncan, who brought him back and made him ultimately into a movie star. Lee became very wealthy and lived the Hollywood life, had a house in Malibu, a house in Beverly Hills, which was his main house. And then in the Depression, first of all, Rin Tin Tin was fired from Warner Brothers in a very cruel, cruel gesture, I think. The letter said, as you know, dogs do not talk. And talking films had suddenly, you know, become very vogue. It's sad. I mean, it's actually hilarious, but kind of painful. And then Lee lost a lot of money in the Depression and eventually lost his house in Beverly Hills. So part of what I went to find where Rin Tin Tin is buried, the original one, And I think you don't need to know more than that for this to make sense. And again, I'm sorry about my voice. This I know it's really annoying, so bear with me. If you take the Paris Metro to the Marie Clichy station and walk north along the wide, shabby Rue Mart, past the long blocks of tire shops and falafel stands and storefronts selling plastic laundry baskets, you will eventually come to a small bridge that arches over the Seine. The bank on the far side is steep, slick with moss, and sags towards the river like an old man's shoulders, as if it were just too weary to hold itself up anymore. Le Cimetière des Chiens, the Cemetery of Dogs, is a few steps west of the bridge, sagging on that saggy bank under a heavy canopy of huge brooding trees. I had come to Le Cimetière des Chiens to find Rin Tin Tin on a hot day in August. It was the kind of day when Paris feels becalmed, stewing in the thick air, and the few people outside at midday move at a sleepwalker's pace down the quiet streets. Just a few cars puttered by in the dull sunlight as I walked alone down Rue Mart, and I was alone in the cemetery as I roamed among the tombstones of Titi and Hippie and Pussy and Room, looking for the grave of Rin Tin Tin. When Lee buried Rinty, he probably thought he would spend his life in his Beverly Hills house, and that he would therefore always be near Rinty's grave. He had buried him in the backyard in Beverly Hills. But in 1933, just months after the dog's death, Lee's money ran out, and the mortgage on the house slid out of reach. When the bank foreclosed, he moved to the small house in North Hollywood he had originally bought for his sister. There is no mention anywhere of when Lee moved Rinty's casket, but this would have been the logical time to do so, because he still had access to the backyard. He could have moved the casket to his sister's, but Lee's living situation was so upended that he must have wanted to bury Rin Tin Tin somewhere more permanent. There were pet cemeteries in the United States at the time. The oldest in the country, Hartsdale Pet Cemetery in New York, had opened in 1896, and the oldest in California in 1918. But Rin Tin Tin had been born in France, so burying him there did have a satisfying symmetry. But it is surprising that Lee would have wanted to be so far from the grave, or would have gone to so much trouble when he could have buried him nearby, far more cheaply and easily. So how did it happen? Maybe a fan paid for the expenses, or a friend. Le Cimetière des Chiens has no record of when Rin Tin Tin arrived and was reburied, and will only say that someone paid the annual fee for the grave, at least for a while. Lee's memoir doesn't cover this period of time. In fact, the memoir ends abruptly at the end of page 124, in mid-sentence, in the middle of one of the condolence letters from which Lee was quoting. The letter is from a fan of Rin Tin Tin's who sounds fumbling, apologetic, mournful. The letter begins, "Rin Tin Tin was the unusual, exceptional, even marvelous. Pardon my saying, for a livelihood I go from door to door selling articles for household use, and in many, many places they own German police dogs, some beautiful, some very vicious. But each place I am protected, and I often think this is..." And then there is no more. That is the last page. The rest of Lee's notes were lost. And there's no other trail leading from Beverly Hills to Rinty's Parisian grave. Le Cimetière des Chiens was founded in 1899 by a group of intellectual pet lovers that included Emile Zola and Marguerite Duran, after Paris passed a law prohibiting animal graves within 100 yards of human habitation. Pet dogs were a relatively new notion in 1899. Dogs, the very first domesticated animals, had lived with people for thousands of years, but until the 19th century, they always had jobs, hunting or herding or guarding. Keeping an animal in the house as a companion is so common now that it's easy to forget how fundamentally odd it is, and what a leap it must have been to share living quarters with a non-human life form just for company. Once dogs became valued as companions, they were elevated to a quasi-human status and were often treated like small, mute people. In the 1800s, a wave of best-selling dog autobiographies were published, life stories purported to be written by the dogs themselves, including Memoirs of Bob, the Spotted Terrier, written by himself, and The Life of Carlo, the Famous Dog of Drury Lane Theater, which began, "My mother was so gentle, she would have not hurt a worm. My father I never saw, as he lived in a distant part of town and visited my mother but seldom." A proper Parisian dog of the time had a wardrobe of shirts, gowns, bathing suits, and underwear, as well as wedding clothes, since dog weddings were common, as well as personalized calling cards and stationery. This is nonfiction. I want to remind you. At the time, it was believed that dogs had deeper feelings and a greater capacity for expressing them than people did, and that their faithfulness was unimpeachable. This was the period when fascination with the incredible journey first began. That is, the story of a dog separated from its owners by accident that somehow overcomes circumstance to make its way home. This canine odyssey has been repeated countless times. The stories might or might not have been true, but they were underpinned by the belief that a dog really could be that constant and loyal. Even Victor Hugo had an incredible journey story, claiming that his poodle, which he accidentally left behind on a trip to Moscow, made its way home on its own to Paris. Dogs, it was believed, remain loyal even after we are gone. In the 19th century imagination, dogs were the most indefatigable mourners. They were said to visit their masters' graves on their own, lying on the freshly turned dirt for days, inconsolable. If their grief was too much to bear, dogs sometimes committed suicide. Newspapers of the period carried frequent reports of these canine sacrifices. One of the great attractions of having a pet then was believing it would miss us and mourn us and always remember us, even if friends and family let us down. The grieving dog was such a fixture in the Victorian mind that it crowded out an unalterable fact. A dog's life is a short one, so most of the time we are mourning them. Le Cimetière des Chiens is an elegant space set off from the street by a Baroque stone entryway and a curlicued iron gate. It's very Parisian, shady and somber, filled with spindly rose bushes and overgrown impatience and gnarly topiary. Inside, near the guardhouse, gravel paths radiate outward from an enormous stone sculpture of a Saint Bernard named Barry. More than 3,000 animals are buried in the cemetery, mostly dogs and cats, but also birds and horses, several monkeys, and at least one pig. I read Barry's gravestone, "He saved 40 lives," and then started down one of the gravel paths. A few wild-looking cats were loafing on a tombstone, watching me with narrowed eyes and then vanishing as soon as I got close, as if they were some sort of optical illusion. The graves were arranged in haphazard rows, a jumble of shapes and sizes like a mouth of very bad teeth, big marble mausoleums beside tiny tombstones, beside small granite markers that bore laminated photographs of the deceased. I passed the graves of Funny and Dudu and Dick and Ching Ling Fu, my best and most devoted friend. He loved only me. And Waddle and Cowboy and Rita and Tushy, Ricky Ticky and Mizuki and Chiquita and Merrill. The headstone for Harry, a stout black Labrador, had a glass globe on top that was filled with 3 half-gnawed tennis balls. A basset hound named Piggy was memorialized with a photograph of himself in better days, chewing on a knuckle bone. The oldest graves for Belgrano, who left this world in 1906, and Mirai, gone in 1903, were as smooth as pats of butter, the carvings of their names almost melted away. The cemetery guard was a short man with a rosy face and the body of a bowler, a tight fit in his little guardhouse near the entrance. He had given me the map to the cemetery, and I noticed Rin Tin Tin's grave marked on it along with some other famous dogs, but as soon as I saw the name, I folded up the map and stuck it in my backpack. I wanted to find the grave on my own. As I walked along, I suddenly and unaccountably felt reluctant to find Rin Tin Tin's grave. Maybe I was a little superstitious about something that seemed so significant to me, and I was braced for the letdown that I know occurs when an event you have anticipated for a long time, that has grown nearly boundless in your mind, finally takes place. Under the full, fat branches of the chestnut trees, the air in the cemetery was cool and soothing. It struck me that Le Cimetière des Chiens would be a very pleasant place for a picnic if you didn't mind being surrounded by a few thousand dead dogs. I sat down on a double gravestone for poodles named Una and Udawa to bide my time. My mind wandered. Were Una and Udawa just friends, or were they mates? Could they have been siblings? Why were they buried together? I looked around, leaning a bit heavily on Una. Someone had left a plastic figurine of Doc, the most senior of the seven dwarves, across from Una and Udawa, on Toby the Schnauzer's grave. Insects clicked and buzzed in the grass. One of the stray cats reappeared and rubbed its back on the headstone of Iris the Collie, using raised letters that said, "My love is stronger than death," to relieve his itch. Bijou the Spaniel was lucky. I could see he had just received fresh flowers. Twigsy's flowers, on the other hand, were plastic. But he also had a plastic ducky that had been yellow, but now looked like a ghost duck, bleached white by the sun and rain. I wish I had brought a picnic with me. I decided to walk around a little more. Look at all these graves. A fat husky named Ferris. Next to him, Tessa. Then another Tessa. Many, many Ulysses. Who names a dog Ulysses? So French. I bet there aren't two dogs in the U.S. named Ulysses. And then there it was, just across from me, a small rectangle made of dark marble, stacked on another rectangle with a tarnished bronze marker that said, Rin Tin Tin, la grande vedette du cinéma. Rin Tin Tin, the great film star. On top of the marble was a metal fitting that might have once held a statue or urn. Someone had placed purple and white lilacs, fake but genuine looking, in a planter beside the gravestone. Next to that, a red and white pinwheel spun in the breeze, whirring into pink. The ground on one side of the gravestone, damp and velvety with bright green moss, had heaved up and shifted, tilting the grave as if it were being tossed on a wave in the sea. It was just a hunk of stone and a moldering bit of ground, and nothing, nothing at all of the idea of what he had been. And for all I knew, Rin Tin Tin wasn't even buried there, which almost stood to reason, since no one could explain to me how he had really gotten here from Beverly Hills. But it was enough to know that this was a marker, a sign that he had lived. If only feelings really could be contained in a block of marble or a brass urn, if there could be a gathering up of permanence, how reassuring, how comforting to think that something you love could be held in place, moored and everlasting. The modesty of the grave made me sad, but I knew Lee believed that there would always be a Rin Tin Tin. So this was only a click in a turning wheel. After the first Rin Tin Tin died, he did still live, and lives still. An idea more than an entity, always different, but essentially the same. Remembering was what made him permanent. I brushed away the leaves that had fallen on the gravestone, straightened the plastic lilacs. I shoved the bottom marble rectangle with my foot to see if I could kick it back into alignment with the other piece. It moved not a bit. The heave must have occurred years ago, and now, as crooked as it was, the stone was settled into place and would stay that way. The guard was playing solitaire in his booth, twiddling his mustache as he stared at his cards, and it took him a moment to notice me standing at the door. I asked him if he could tell me anything about Rin Tin Tin's grave. My terrible French made him grin. He said that many, many people had come looking for it. A few years ago, an American came, he said. He wanted to make a big monument for him, a big statue instead of his small grave, but he shrugged. No news, he said, and shrugged again. No news. I asked him who had left the flowers in the pinwheel. He sighed. An old lady. She used to come regularly and put the flowers on his grave, fresh flowers at first, and then plastic. He started to shuffle his cards again and then stopped, tapping the deck on his desk, the sharp knocking sounding like a woodpecker drilling into a tree. I thanked him and started to leave, and as he cut the deck, he called to me, "You know, I haven't seen that old lady in some time. No, I think perhaps she is dead. That's what I think." Thank you. Thank you very much.
This is KESKA Anchorage, and you're listening to Addressing Alaskans with Susan Orlean, author and columnist for New Yorker Magazine. She was recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 1st at a Cross Currents event hosted by the 49 Alaska Writing Center. In the second half of the program, Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley joined Susan on stage to talk about writing people and place.
So one of the things I was thinking about is, as I have been rereading your work in preparation for you coming here, is how does you pick a subject? What is it that makes you want to write about someone or something?
You know, I think I've always had I respond as a reader. I hear about something, and if I have an impulse where I think, oh, I want to know more, and I'm thinking of that not, oh, that's a good story, as much as thinking, oh, I wonder about that. And where those ideas come from, they can be really varied. I mean, with Rin Tin Tin, for instance, I was happened to be doing another story. I was working on a story about American Humane, and those are the people who give the No Animal Is Harmed credential to films. And I followed around their crew as they were observing animals. And I started learning about the history of animals in Hollywood, which was really fascinating, and came across the name of Rin Tin Tin. And I had this intense reaction of thinking, oh God, I was such a fixture when I was a tiny kid. And I read something that suggested that he'd actually been a real dog. And I thought, no, he was a character. And that instant feeling of, I want to know more. So I'm really drawn to things by my own, and my interests are very broad. I'm interested in things I don't know anything about, in things that I initially have a really negative reaction to, you know, sort of curious. I love stories where I think, boy, you couldn't pay me $1 million to do that. So, you know, and you could actually pay me
$1 million would do.
Yeah. But that feeling of, why would anyone want to do that, to me is a very attractive feeling instead of a repellent feeling. I just think, that's how I wrote The Orchid Thief. I thought, why would anyone go into a swamp to get orchids? Why wouldn't you just go to Home Depot? You know, so that feeling of, I don't get it. I mean, ultimately, my curiosity is, at the risk of making it sound too grand, it's just a question of, why do people care about the things they care about? How is it that we make life seem like it is meaningful? And I feel like I understand the things I care about. What I'm very curious about are the things that are not naturally appealing to me. And I think, well, somebody cares about this. So what makes that happen? And how can I figure it out? And where does it lead me? I mean, Rin Tin Tin drew me into this, you know, sweep of history through this very interesting little keyhole of this character of the dog. So it was another way of following a huge story that's too big to consume, which is 100 years of history, through a very particular narrow lens on it. So it's, and I'm always surprised. I rarely write about the same thing more than once, so I'm often surprised, and I'll midway through a story think, how did I end up writing a story about, you know, grocery stores or, and then one more thing, just not to belabor the point, but I like writing stories where I take an incredibly mundane subject, a 10-year-old boy, a supermarket, and say, it's not ordinary. There's actually, if you just look at it a little more closely, it's wonderful. And I really am drawn to those subjects that seem on the face of it to be so usual that you wouldn't give it a second thought. And the fact is, you've never given a second thought to it because of it seeming so usual. And I love the feeling of the thing falling apart in front of my eyes in the best sense, that instead of it seeming like this complete little kind of nugget, it opens into a whole world.
You were talking to the press club today, and someone asked you about how your reporting works, and you were stressing that a lot of it is observational, that you spend time watching people and that you don't prepare too much beforehand. But I wonder, you know, over time, what you've learned about being an observer, and what makes for a good observer, sort of what lessons you've learned in that.
I'm almost reluctant to answer this because I feel like I have so much, I can improve so much. I think, for one thing, I think the most, probably one of the great advantages in being a good observer is to be non-judgmental and be willing to be surprised and be willing to be humble about not knowing something. And I think a lot of times you're in situations and you're so caught up in your expectation of what they are and what you already know about them that it's very hard to just be there and pay attention and be willing to be surprised. I love being in new situations. I think that's part of it too, is that I really like being exposed to that feeling of, some people would find it discomfort. I like being jarred out of what's usual. And I think that's when you start noticing. I mean, it's a little like when you live in New York and you have visitors who say, oh, Statue of Liberty, you go, huh? Oh yeah, Statue of Liberty. You know, but that freshness and the surprise is when I think you start noticing. So I like putting myself in situations where there's a bit of discomfort. I'm really not, I don't have somewhere to retreat. I never take anyone with me when I'm reporting. I have on rare occasions, but I feel like you've got to go by yourself. And, you know, when I was working on my first book, Saturday Night, where I traveled to about 18 different kinds of communities around the United States and spent Saturday night, and the truest thing that I came out of the book knowing was that on Saturday night, people like to be with the people they know. It's the night where you want to be among what's, your comfort zone. And I thought, and I have just spent 5 years of my life spending Saturday night with strangers. But I also read at the time this survey where American adults were asked what their number one, their top fears were. The number one fear was swimming, and I thought that was amazing. And their number two fear was being at parties with strangers. That's how I live my life. I am at parties with strangers, or I'm alone, and it's sometimes very lonesome, and it's sometimes awkward, and you kind of have to develop lots of techniques for not feeling like a jerk. But I do think that you do your best observing when you're thrown onto your own resources that way. And since most of us live lives where we cover familiar territory, you get out of the habit. You know, that's just natural, and I'm in the habit since I do it as any reporter, but also I don't cover a beat. So each time I start a story, I'm learning from the ground up, and so I'm always back in that position of, look, I don't know anything. I've got to observe fast, I've got to figure it out.
What do you tell your students about getting started? You know, they've done their reporting, they're ready to write. What advice do you give them about that moment?
My first advice is, you're not ready to write. And they hate me. I guess I'll just reiterate what we were talking about a little bit in the session earlier today. I think the biggest mistake anybody makes is writing too quickly, that you do your reporting and you instantly start writing and you spend no time processing and thinking about what was interesting, what did you learn, what's the real point of what you're doing. Now, I think that it's the difference between, you want both the first impression, which is that really fresh, quick response to new situations you're observing. But then there has to be a deeper level where you think through, why did I pick this story? What was important about this? And I don't think you can answer that. Or even, how can I convince other people to find this interesting? I think you need some time to figure it out before you sit down to write. And that writing shouldn't be the process by which you figure out what the story was. So I intend to encourage them to put aside their notes, talk about the story without notes in front of them to someone, and tell them what the story was, and use that as a way to begin hearing what they're saying. I don't know if you've had this experience, but I will sometimes say I've gone on a trip and I come back and people ask me about the trip, and what I tell them surprises me. I think, wow, I guess what was interesting was not the thing I thought would be interesting. I find myself telling this other anecdote. But that, I think, is this valuable way that you're sort of sifting through what was really interesting and coming to it naturally. Then I usually, with my students who say, yeah, right, thanks. Then I usually say, I encourage them, even though I don't tend to write like this, to write scenes if they're not ready to really write their lead, and begin putting words on a page so that they're starting to limber their muscles. And I feel like eventually you write your way to where you need to be. Ideally, you're doing it in your head, but you can also do it on paper.
I know that you have have done editing and had editors, and I think that for any writer, that's a really central and important relationship. I wondered if you could talk about who to you have been good editors, and then also what kind of an editor you are.
I've actually been really lucky. I've had a lot of great editors. To begin with, and very fortunately, my first real extensive writing job when I was just out of college, I had an editor who talked to me about this sort of moral responsibility of being a writer. And I have to say, I don't think we hear that enough. And it's something that certainly when I teach, I try to talk about. Being a writer and the privilege it is and what it means and what responsibility you should feel and I don't mean the ethics of do you make up quotes. I mean, that of course needs to be talked about. I mean the bigger moral question of what does it mean to have a louder voice than the average person, because that's what writers have, and what you choose to write about and why, and what how you should think about that. Not that you always get to make those choices, but in any case, I had an editor who really emphasized that, and also the role that a publication can play in a community and what that means. When I moved on to working at bigger magazines and at The New Yorker, I had editors who, it was almost, sometimes almost creepy. I felt like they could see what I was trying to do with the story better than I could. They'd say, well, obviously you're working on this theme here about, memory, and you think, I am. They had, and so they weren't tinkering with the writing, except if there was a need for clarity, as much as they were trying to coalesce more clearly the themes of what I was trying to say. And I think that, and also helping a lot with structure. I mean, The New Yorker has great editors who both appreciate that each writer has a different voice, but also they see their role as getting you to your who you are as a writer better. I think that I've had really good relationships with editors even when I've disagreed with them, or I never felt that it was adversarial. I didn't, but I haven't worked at a daily newspaper, and I have to say, I know that there are luxuries in working for a magazine that daily newspapers don't have, and I don't feel you can compare them exactly. I, as an editor, what I like to do with people is push them to see, first of all, a whole different way they could take the whole story, and not just as an exercise, but to say, and maybe it's from learning it from good editors, because I'm not an experienced editor, but I feel that I can read a story and look at it and think, you know what, I'm seeing a better story in here that you're not seeing because you went out expecting to do this story. And so I think the advantage I have is I don't go in expecting a certain story to emerge. And so I try to push people to see, well, that wasn't the story that you found. You went thinking you were writing this, but actually look at this much better, more interesting story. And kind of liberating them from this was the story I was expecting to write. I believe that language at its best is quite plain. So I think in unconfident writers tend to trick up their writing too much. So one of the things I like to do is encourage people to appreciate how strong, really plain language spoken in a really, sometimes even an unadorned way, can be very, very strong, and then it makes description just jump off the page because it's so alive. But I really like plain language. I like straightforwardness in a way. And I push people a lot to think about the kind of tonal quality of what they're writing. I feel like everything should have a melody in a way, and it should be beautiful to hear it. And that it should be read out loud, and it should be edited with that in mind to make, because you read it, even when you're not reading it out loud, to a reader, there's something very different about reading a piece that has, that's rhythmically manipulated by the writer, so you move through it in a really comfortable way, sometimes quickly, sometimes slow down. It should be really fun to read pieces and have that kind of experience, and I think that's a mechanical thing. You get somebody to sit down and look at their piece and see the way the sentences move.
This is Addressing Alaskans, and you're listening to ADN columnist Julia O'Malley's onstage interview with New Yorker columnist Susan Orlean, recorded at the Anchorage Museum on April 1st.
Okay, so she has 100,000 Twitter followers, FYI. I wanted to ask you about Twitter and how you started it, and kind of what the experience has been like for you. That's sort of the first part of the question. And then I wonder too if you could talk about the interaction between what you're tweeting, what you're blogging, and what you're writing, and if there is any relationship.
My Twitter odyssey, as it were, it's kind of funny because I got on Twitter maybe a year ago, or a year and a half, I can't remember, but something like that. And I had an assistant at the time who said to me, you should really get on Twitter. And I said, what's Twitter? So well, just here, I'll sign you up, you know, say stuff occasionally. And I couldn't figure it out. I just couldn't begin to imagine how it worked. And until I started using a different interface so that I could kind of see it and get it, I neglected it. And then I think I had just gotten my chickens, I think. And I mean, no one else wanted to hear about my chickens. And the great thing about Twitter is no one can say to you, shut up. They just unfollow you. So I was just sort of chatting. And it took quite a while until I suddenly thought, oh, this is kind of fun, both because I found a really interesting craft in making these tiny statements little tiny stories. And not all of them, certainly, and some of them, you know, I have done the occasional lunch tweet of just had a hamburger, and then I think, oh my God, did I just do that? I can't believe it. Or asking tech questions, which is a very easy use of Twitter. And the other thing is that because I don't write constantly, I suddenly thought, wow, I can talk to people during this long period where I'm working on my book and I'm kind of falling off the face of the earth, and I can actually start talking a little to readers about writing the book. And I actually then, in a completely selfish way, began saying to people, God, I really hope I get 1,000 words written today. And then I get back 50 people saying, come on, you can do it. And I thought, this is great. Like, wow. And, you know, and people would ask me, how's it come? It was actually really interesting. That's, that's one of the phenomena of social media, which is the way there is an actual interaction. And you can say, well, you don't even know these people, but you do know them. You know them in that context. But it's funny to now be writing in tweets, which are 140 characters. I have a blog on the New Yorker website, which is short. I mean, it can range, but that can be 200 words, 500, whatever. Magazine pieces, which I haven't done anything for a while because I've been on a book read, but those are, you know, 5,000 words and up. And then my book, which I just finished, and it's 150,000 words. So to write in all those different lengths, in a way I feel like they're all consistent. It's a conversation that takes lots of different forms. I like the exercise of trying each form. Sometimes I'll tweet something and then think, wow, I could do a blog post actually and expand it a little. Sometimes I'll do a blog post and think, you know, that could actually be a story. And when I began Rin Tin Tin, and certainly when I started The Orchid Thief, it was a story where I thought, you know what, this could be a book. So I don't see them as not continuous. I mean, I'm not going to write a story saying, does someone know how to fix, you know, the hard drive of my MacBook, which is a tweet that one might post. You know, but more generally, I feel like it's a continuous conversation. I guess I've begun to feel that I'm, for better or worse, sort of talking to a certain group of people who aren't traveling the places I'm going or don't have the time to spend 7 years as I did learning about a dog, and I'm so happy that I did. You know, I'm doing things that they may find very interesting that they're not doing. So I'm kind of talking about it, and I'm talking about it in these different forms. It's very different from 5 years ago, obviously, where things were really written in stone, delivered as a formal unit, and there was simply no, with an impermeable boundary. And that is no longer the case. I feel that these things have grown to merge together as a conversation in a lot of different forms. I mean, and now I'm finishing my book and we're already working on the ebook and the enhanced video version of the book. You know, that's just the world we live in now. So I think it's a continuous thing. I don't see them as different identities.
Are we ready for audience questions? So,
please raise your hand. And we'll come back.
Just raise your hand. She will give you a card, and they will come back and pick them up. While they're doing that, I was wondering if you could just say what the process is of a story. How long it takes from conception to the story happening in New Yorker? Like, what's that process like?
A typical story for me, I would say it's probably 2 months when all is said and done between coming up with the idea, doing the reporting, doing the writing, and, you know, getting it through the mill at the New Yorker. I've done stories faster. You know, and that may sound really long, but I just know, thinking of the story I did most recently, which was about mules in the military. And I had to do a couple trips, I had a lot of reporting, and it just sort of stretched into being about a month before I was able to assemble all the reporting. And then it took about 2 weeks to write, and probably a week or so before the editing, fact-checking, everything got processed.
How does the editing work? How much do you go back and forth?
the way it works now is, I mean, it's changed. We used to do all the editing on paper, but I give it to my editor. She'll send it back to me with changes, and we go over them all. Although now I'm much more efficient. You know, it's like comma change. I don't care. Let's move on. But it's a discussion, and every now and again, if you come to an absolute disagreement about something, it doesn't happen that much. I mean, I feel like, you know, you'll sometimes get stuck on a phrase or something you want to put in and they want to take out, and you go around a bit, but it's generally negotiated. And then the fact-checking is famously nitpicking, and that is something where you actually cannot believe that this person has gone and fact-checked literally every single thing in your story. If you say it was a warm day, the fact-checkers are all over-educated, and they have like a power thing with a lot of the writers, and they'll say, you know, I checked the newspaper, it was actually 68 that day. I mean, I wouldn't technically call it warm. I checked in the Oxford English Dictionary, and warm is usually defined as 70 to 77. And you just think, oh, I can't believe this is happening. And everything. I mean, it's hilarious sometimes. They also, you know, but that's a process that is gone. You know, I sort of enjoy it when I'm not ready to kill myself. And then there's a copy edit at the end, too. So the story in The New Yorker ends up going through many cycles before it's finally in the magazine, and we actually have cut out like three or four of those processes in the interest of time and efficiency. It used to go through several other readers, and you know, it was quite elaborate.
Any questions? Okay.
Who are your authors, the ones that you read to learn from, the ones that you are stimulated by?
I read and love and idolize Joan Didion, John McPhee. When I was younger, I read Tom Wolfe, and it was just sort of blew my mind and made me think, okay, this, I'm gonna be a writer. Lillian Ross, A.J. Liebling. You know, it sounds a little like I'm just saying all of the greatest hits from The New Yorker, but that's probably pretty accurate. I also, in my spare time, mainly read fiction, and I actually think it's an important thing for, but not just for pleasure, which is why I do it, but also to read for writing and be refreshed all the time with people who are writing in the form of fiction. I have, for what it's worth, on my website, I believe, I had asked people on Twitter to just give me the names of the great nonfiction pieces that they loved. And I ended up with hundreds. And I think it's on my website now. So, and I've said to people sometimes, and you know, these were, not every single one of them was something I'd read, but a lot of them were pieces that I'd read and really influenced me. And so I put it up on my website because I thought it would be a great resource for people. And so I think it's there, I have to look. And that's just SusanRomine.com.
So is our time up?
Thank you, Julia.
appreciate it, and I hope I get to come back sometime soon. Thank you.
This is KSKA Anchorage, and you've been listening to Addressing Alaskans with New Yorker columnist Susan Orlean and Anchorage Daily News columnist Julia O'Malley. The 49 Alaska Writing Center hosted the event as part of their Cross Current series at the Anchorage Museum on April 1st, 2011. A special thanks to Mark Weber at the Anchorage Museum for recording the event. You can download today's program or subscribe to free podcasts of Addressing Alaskans on our website at kska.org. To let us know about an upcoming community event that you would like to hear on Addressing Alaskans, just go to kska.org and click on Contact Us at the bottom of the page. This has been a production of KSKA Public Radio in Anchorage, Alaska. For KSKA, I'm Kristen Spack. Thanks for listening.